We are talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Have you both here.
Good afternoon.
Good to have you back, Jav.
It's nice to be back.
to the extent that I am. Yeah,
yeah,
it sounded like it was a hellish week for you. So
it was.
You know, we don't normally do this. You do it occasionally on your Facebook page, but how do people support your work financially? Don't you have a web page?
I do. You can go to jav.org, and there's a PayPal button there, or you can just search my name on Venmo. That works, too.
And Jav is spelled G-E-O-V.
Yes.
.org.
Parrish, P-A-R-R-I-S-H. I'm always amazed at how many people master the first name and can't spell the last name. So
two R's, yeah.
Yes.
But your website address is gov.com?
Or .org.
.org.
.org. Okay. Yeah, because I'm an organism.
All right.
I'll remember that.
So let's dive into what transpired this last week. There was we talked about the election results the week before, but there was more ballots trickling in this week. It seems to be down to a trickle.
Yeah,
but
there was
some things have changed.
Yeah, there's not that many left, but the trend which we see in most elections of progressive candidates getting more votes over time as the votes come in, is very much holding true this time. There's been some dramatic changes from the election night results. In the mayor's race, Bruce Harrell now has a fairly narrow lead over Lorena Gonzalez, 34.02% to 32.10%. Harrell was up by about 12% on election night. Yeah. So that's changed a lot.
That's less than 4,000 votes now. So that's interesting.
Yeah, and you have to say that Gonzalez is the favorite at this point for the November election, because if you look at all the other candidates, and there were a bazillion of them on the ballot, and where the other votes all went, third place was Colleen Echohawk, and Lord knows where her votes came from. That might be a split. But fourth was Jessen Farrell. And you'd have to figure that most of her votes are going to go to Gonzalez. So I think Gonzalez is in very good shape.
Yeah. So I think it's kind of hard sometimes in a race like this with so many different candidates, but with so many of the candidates who got plenty of votes, like Colleen Echohawk with her 21,000 votes and Farrell with her almost 15,000 votes, they ran on campaigns as outsiders from city politics. So if people were just kind of reflexively voting for someone who's an outsider, then Harrell might pick up some of those votes, because that's how he's campaigning right now, even though that's not strictly true. He isn't really an outsider to city politics.
So, yeah, the fact that he was city council president and was on council for 10 years
means he's not an outsider.
No, yeah. Not at all.
Yeah. But if folks were voting on the issues and they happened to like Colleen Echohawk's issues, particularly her homelessness solutions, and they liked Jessen Farrell for her positions, then I think they would be a natural fit to be supporters of Lorena Gonzalez. So then if you start adding them up and tallying them, Gonzalez is well ahead of Bruce Harrell by at least 10%. Of the votes that were cast in the primary. And then I
promise you that both Harrell and Gonzalez have been scrambling to wrap up endorsements from the other candidates.
Yeah. And if you think that not enough people voted in the primary, I think you're wrong, because turnout in Seattle was close to 42%, which is really good.
That's very high for an
August primary. Yeah. That doesn't include national races. For example, if you look at the turnout in the broader King County, they had a little over 34%, almost 10% less than we had, in spite of electing the King County executive and three county council races that could change the political balance of the county council. So clearly a lot of voters in Seattle are focused on this election. And mm-hmm. I think that's good news for Gonzalez, because I think people were voting on specific issues that they care about. And that means that more of the progressive candidates total took more votes than Harrell and some of the more conservative candidates in the mayor's race.
Yeah, and Gonzalez also has an advantage in that she can actually articulate what her positions are.
Whereas so, not true for Harrell.
No.
Okay. So the Seattle city attorney, I'd be interested, Jav, in hearing your take on that race.
I'm really pretty shocked that Pete Holmes, a 10-year incumbent, did not make it through the primary. And, you know, we saw on election night where Ann Davison, who's spectacularly unqualified to be city attorney, was in the lead. But she is no longer in the lead. Nicole Thomas Kennedy, who ran on an abolitionist platform, is now in the lead with 36.37%. Davison is second with 32.73%, and Holmes has conceded. So he will no longer be city attorney. We will have a new city attorney, and you couldn't have a starker contrast between the NIMBY Republican and Davison and the pretty much radical left, Nicole Thomas Kennedy.
Yeah. What's interesting is Thomas Kennedy didn't just take the lead. She's about 7,000 votes ahead of Ann Davison, which I think may be because some folks in this race were urging people to vote for Thomas Kennedy as a strategic vote so that to try to lock Ann Davison out of the final. And I just want to say, I think this is an example of where strategic voting can really turn around and bite you if your favorite candidate, Pete Holmes, doesn't make it through.
Yeah. I think a lot of people assumed that Holmes was automatic to make it through, and it was down to, you know, the other two as to which one would make it through. But they both did. So we're going to have quite the contrast for November between those two candidates.
Yeah.
And then go ahead.
Before we go on, one factor that just occurred to me with that particular race come November is because of the extreme distance between those two candidates on the way they see things, I picture there'll be a lot of people that won't cast their vote for either one, and that will heavily skew things potentially in that race.
Well, again, because so many people voted in the August primary in the Seattle races, I think it's not going to make a whole lot of difference. I think we'll see a similar result in the final if Mike, that you think that's the case.
Yeah, and
because
usually
the people who support the left position, even if they were Holmes supporters and they strategically voted for Nicole Thomas Kennedy, I think the bulk of them will not have a problem voting for her in the final.
Yeah, and
we shall see.
You know, the November election tends to skew more progressive, younger, less affluent than a and less north end than an August primary does. So that all works in the favor not only of Thomas Kennedy, but also Holmes, but also Gonzalez and also Nikita Oliver. And we'll talk about that in a second.
Yeah. So, well, let's talk about that one.
Yeah. City council race position number 9. We had three major candidates. Brianna Thomas is a distant third. On election night, Sarah Nelson, who's the establishment pro-business candidate, was well ahead of Nikita Oliver by about 8%. But Nikita Oliver has caught Nelson. Oliver now has 40.16%. Nelson has 39.49%. So a fairly narrow lead at this point. But you've got to think that Nikita is in good position for the final.
Yeah, I think, it kind of makes a difference as to why people cast their vote for Brianna Thomas. If they voted for her because she was a woman of color and they were looking for a candidate who is fairly progressive but and a woman of color, then they may fairly easily and comfortably vote for Nikita Oliver in the final if they were looking for a person of color. Now, if they were voting for Brianna Thomas because of her experience as Lorena Gonzalez's chief of staff and her long experience on the council and her kind of wonkish knowledge of city council politics, they might be persuaded to vote for Sarah Nelson, because Nelson has been playing up her experience having worked as an aide to Richard Conlon when he was a city council member.
10 years ago. Yeah.
Yeah. So it may be kind of interesting to see how Thomas's votes split. But I think Nikita Oliver is pretty well positioned, but this race could be very, very close in November.
And if people are concerned about the wonkishness, Oliver seems to have a much better command of the issues, at least so far in the campaign, than Nelson does.
They do. Oliver does have a very good understanding of the issues and can articulate their position really well, whereas Sarah Nelson has been struggling to do that. But I think these three races, the Gonzalez versus Harrell, Oliver versus Nelson, and Thomas Kennedy versus Davison matchups, are really going to determine what the voters of Seattle want, to move ahead faster with a progressive agenda or to roll back to the tough on crime, punish people because of their poverty, and shovel out taxpayer money to big businesses, which is the way things used to be 20 some years ago here in Seattle. So I think right now we're at one of those inflection points politically where a backlash could happen. But and if you think about what we've been through in the last year and a half with the COVID-19 lockdown and the economic downturn, that's pretty scary stuff. And sometimes when people are scared, they will vote for more conservative candidates. So it'll be interesting to see if people in the November election vote out of fear or if they vote out of hope, you know?
Yeah. And you know, fear is powerful, but hope is even more powerful.
Yeah, I think so. And I think even in the face of economic stress and the pandemic pressures, that Seattle voters are going to vote to move faster with the progressive agenda.
And, you know, given the economic downturn and the need for social safety net programs, you know, it's not a time for, you know, libertarian type politics. It's a time for government intervention. And I think people have appreciated seeing that over the past year.
Yeah.
So that also argues in favor of the progressive candidates.
Yeah, that you need people who are willing to step up and do something, not roll things back to a laissez-faire government doesn't help people position.
Yep.
Let the free market decide isn't gonna cut it right now.
No.
Well, the free market will be casting its vote via several PACs.
Yes.
Well, interestingly enough, in the mayor's race, both the leading candidates have PACs. And there's been some discussion that in the mayor's race, and this was the first year that democracy vouchers were used in the mayor's race, that the democracy vouchers really didn't make a whole lot of difference because the leading candidates who won those, Andrew Grant Houston, for example, didn't really do well in the primary.
No.
It was the two candidates.
It did not transfer into votes. Colleen Echohawk and Andrew Grant Houston were the two leading candidates for democracy vouchers, and they didn't make it.
Right. And instead, we saw the two candidates with big PAC money behind them make it through to the final. Of course, those are the two candidates with name recognition as well. So, you know, kind of hard to tell.
And who had run previous campaigns. Don't underestimate that. That makes a big difference.
That does make a big difference. And that's kind of part of the name recognition thing. So.
Sure. Yeah, but
and people like to vote for candidates. A lot of people like to vote for candidates who have experience, political experience behind them as well.
But the democracy vouchers did allow Andrew Grant Houston to be able to be in a race
to actually
and articulate – articulate a lot of ideas that other people basically rode on. So he really set the pace for several different, you know, issues that wouldn't have gotten out there otherwise.
Yeah, he did stake out a position on the far left, which I think does pull other candidates who could easily lead to the right further left. I think that's true.
Yeah. And, you know, he ran a very good campaign. It didn't translate into votes, but he's got a bright future. He's pretty young. He's 32, I believe. Mm-hmm. So we're going to hear more from him, I think.
And Echo Hawk, she kind of moved the needle a little bit, too, on homelessness as well. We all knew it was going to be a big issue in this election, but it didn't come down to, you know, what is the city doing or not doing. It's what could the city be doing. And I think she was part of that conversation of what could the city be doing in terms of creative ideas to address homelessness. So that's also something that the democracy vouchers helped to do. I wasn't impressed with Echo Hawk as a candidate, but some of her platform ideas were pretty interesting.
Yeah,
and homelessness is her topic.
And the idea that homelessness, that conversation could have been, well, the city has been wasting money for the last 20 years. We need to cut back. And that really wasn't what dominated the conversation.
Yeah.
All right. Updates on any of the other races?
No, those are the main ones. Teresa Mosqueda, again, is a shoe-in, pretty much, for the
What about Pete von Reichbauer?
Oh, yeah, the race in Pete von Reichbauer's County Council District 7, that's the southwest corner of the county, including Federal Way and Auburn. Von Reichbauer is a 28-year incumbent, and he took 53% of the vote. But the race is really close between two of his three challengers. But there are a few more votes separating them now, 53 votes separating small business owner Dominique Torgerson from Federal Way City Council member Lydia Asifa Dawson. And so it looks like the late returns are favoring Torgerson over Asifa Dawson. And even though Torgerson barely campaigned and ran because she's had a long dispute with the county over zoning for her business for Horseman Brewing in Kent, it looks like Torgerson is going to make it through to the November election. I don't think that's going to change, and I don't think it'll change even if there's a recount in that race. So well, some public safety news this week. The Seattle Police Department presented a report to the City Council's Public Safety Committee on staffing levels at the Seattle Police Department and the budget. In short, they expect to be down 73 more police officers by the end of the year after losing a net of 135 officers last year. This means that there's a salary savings of about $15.4 million. Last year, the City Council tried to claw back about $5 million in salary savings from the Seattle Police Department to spend on community safety projects. But political pressure from the business community, the mayor's office, the Seattle Police Department management, the Seattle Police Officers Guild, and the mainstream media really forced the City Council to put that plan on hold. Now, this report this week was meant to be a revisit of that effort by the council in this year's budget, since they weren't able to actually do it last year. So in the SPD report, in order to forestall this effort by the City Council to take away their salary savings from not hiring as many officers as they expected to, the Seattle Police Department instead gave a list of things that they want to spend that $15 million on.
Oh, and, dear Lord.
Yes, and some of those things are related to community safety. For example, funding for civilian personnel within the police department, including civilian community service officers, more staff to handle public disclosure requests, which I think is desperately needed at the police department, a person to help track bias crimes, at staff to develop and run trainings on equitable policing, especially for new hires, and IT and management support. Now, some of these things are also mandated by the court-ordered consent decree. So they're justifiable expenses. Some of these expenses also are things ordered by the mayor and the city council, like money that would be transferred to fund the new Triage 1 unit, to update the 911 call center to allow calls to be transferred to Triage 1 and Medic 1 instead of just the Seattle Police Department, and additional funding for the Regional Peacekeepers Collective, which is running a pilot program to reduce gun violence in the city. The additional funding would allow the peacekeepers to go from a pilot program to a permanent program. But there's at least a couple of dodgy line items in this budget request. First, after giving the council a depressing view of staffing shortages at the Seattle Police Department and telling Lorena Gonzalez that more money isn't necessarily the answer to the Seattle Police Department's retention problems, that police officers really just want to know that the city council appreciates them, the SPD representative...
Excuse me, for people who carry your own guns all day long, mm-hmm. There's an awful lot of butthurt there.
I know. Now, the SPD representative then went on, and the report says that SPD management isn't really doing much work on retention to try to keep the officers they have. They're just studying the problem still, even though it's been a problem for well over a year. And they want to, and the one thing that they're doing is they hired a mental health expert, and they want to expand that program. That's really their only solution for right now. And even though pay isn't the issue, they want to reintroduce hiring bonuses of $5,000 to $20,000 for new hires. And they stuck a $2.5 million line item into this budget and labeled it potential COVID-related compensation. Okay, which the SPD representative described as hazard pay for police officers who had to work during the COVID pandemic, right? So, okay, you can't tell the city council that pay is not the issue, then ask for bonuses, especially hazard pay. This might be based on the city council's ordinance to force grocery stores to pay their employees hazard pay during the pandemic, but policing is inherently hazardous, okay? And grocery store employees came into contact with many, many more people during a single day than any single Seattle police officer on any given day during the worst of the pandemic. Except, of course, when officers rioted during street protests. But I have to tell you that firing blast balls and gas grenades and chasing protesters for miles on city streets shouldn't qualify you for hazard pay when those officers are already getting overtime pay for doing that. Okay. And by the way, that $3 million line item is also in the budget. It's labeled event overtime for things like Seahawks games, for example. But some of it is also overtime pay for policing protests and rioting during those events. And then there's the line item separation pay shortfall, which is estimated at $2.6 million.
Is that for officers who are getting divorced?
No, it's not. The SPD still, and I want to go back a little bit and talk for a minute about the fact that the Seattle Police Department still has not finished putting into place a modern timekeeping system, and they still rely on paper slips to keep track of officers' hours and pay, which has been extremely controversial over the last 5 years. That's the time frame during which the Seattle Police Department has been saying that it's putting in place a new timekeeping system that's going to be more accurate than these paper slips, right? And we've all read the articles, and we've all heard about officers who are paid overtime and paid for a number of hours that is not humanly possible to work in 1 week. So you have to ask, how do we know that this number is actually accurate, and whether the department is overpaying officers who are leaving and retiring and giving them more separation pay than they are actually qualified to receive? And how do we know that the overtime number is accurate as well? Mm-hmm. So it's really no surprise that the $15.4 million salary savings is melted down to only $64,000 at the bottom of SPD's spending plan that the city council could then use for other purposes. and only 1.5 million of what the SPD wants to keep and spend on their wants to keep and spend would be transferred out to things like Triage One, the 911 call center, and the Regional Peacekeepers Collective. So I want to say that when reporters and conservatives get all upset about Lorena Gonzalez grilling the SPD representative at this week's meeting over SPD's management failings and poor retention policies, they need to ask themselves why she's upset and look more closely at these issues and the background behind SPD management management failings and shortfalls. The city council has a responsibility of fiscal oversight, and they have a responsibility of performance oversight of the SPD. And dumping on a city council member who's doing that is really irresponsible. And that's what I've been seeing in a lot of the media that's been reporting on this this meeting that occurred this week in the city council public safety committee. That SPD management, you know, is never going to come to the city council and say, I'm sorry, we don't know what we're doing, you know?
Yeah. And we've got way too much money here. Have some.
Yeah. And as far as I know, I mean, the one big management failure that generated a lot of headlines last year was the abandonment of the East Precinct, where two of Carmen Best's managers in the Seattle Police Department management team made that decision on their own after the mayor and after Carmen Best said, do not abandon the East Precinct, specifically told her management team, do not abandon the East Precinct. Two of her managers made that decision on their own and just went ahead and did it. And as far as I know,
I'm actually less concerned about that as the fact that once they had done that, response times for anything on Capitol Hill evaporated.
The SPD went on strike.
Yeah, SPD just decided, well, we're not going to police that whole neighborhood.
And a certain sector of the SPD management team was fine with that, you know?
Yeah.
And as far as I know, no consequences have come out of that. No changes have been made, and that management team is still in place, and that's a problem, you know. And I think Gonzalez is perfectly justified, and I was happy to see that at least one city council member in that public safety committee meeting was willing to follow up and say, "What are you doing?" You know,
and Gonzalez maybe the person who's picking the next police chief next year.
Yeah. So, yeah, so we could see more friction there in the future, but I don't think that's a bad thing. Another thing that happened this week in public safety news was there was a hearing in Judge James Robart's courtroom this week on whether Seattle has made progress on police reform under the consent decree with the Department of Justice. Now, the two issues holding the city back from getting out from under the consent decree, which was put in place almost 10 years ago, are one, will the new Seattle Police Officers Guild contract contain all of the reforms that the city council passed into law? Excuse me. And two, how much has the Seattle Police Department's response to the George Floyd protests set the city back in terms of police reform? So to answer the first question, the city's labor relations committee is still defining the terms of what they're going to push for in the contract negotiations, which actually haven't started yet and won't start until early next year after a new mayor has taken office. Of course, one of the first things that new mayor will do, as you pointed out, Job, is start search for a new police chief, since Mayor Durkin has refused to do that. On the second issue, the George Floyd protests and the way that the police abused protesters, the court-appointed monitor, Dr. Antonio Oftili, told the judge that he was still reviewing the SPD's use of force and crowd control policies during the protests and whether those policies violated the consent decree, and that he would present his findings to the court by the end of the year. He was otherwise very complimentary of the other changes made by the SPD under the consent decree. And get this, Judge Robart pointed out that portions of Oftili's mid-year report were written by other people, including Mayor Durkin, which is not how Merrick Bob did his job. Yeah, so that's telling you something kind of interesting about Off Tealy's approach to his job as court-appointed monitor, right? Now, Off Tealy went on to say that as the city shifts work from the Seattle Police Department to civilian teams like the Triage One team, those new civilian public safety groups will have to adhere to the bias-free and constitutional requirements of the consent decree. So it's pretty clear to me that he's saying he's going to be monitoring those groups as well as the Seattle Police Department. Now, Robart obviously couldn't make a decision yet whether to lift the consent decree because things are still in progress. But both he and Off Tealy stress that the Seattle Police Department's progress hinges on adequate staffing and funding. And that was a direct call out, not just to the city council for wanting to make budget cuts to the Seattle Police Department, but I think also to SPD management, who are not putting forward a plan to address their staffing problems. Off Tealy estimated that the Seattle Police Department will need to hire at least another 160 more officers to implement their micro community policing plan. So that could become a problem in negotiations with the city council over the Seattle Police Department budget. And may present a significant hurdle to making deep cuts at the Seattle Police Department. Now, I should point out here that staffing shortfalls, as I did earlier, are not just a problem at the SPD, and they're not necessarily a money problem, right? Many businesses right now are having issues with finding enough qualified employees and getting them hired and trained quickly enough to staff up rapidly as businesses are emerging out of the COVID pandemic lockdown. Management at those businesses and management at the SPD has to work really hard and find creative ways to get new staff in the door. People don't just hire themselves, but people do leave a job on their own, and that can often be a sign of management problems, especially if management isn't doing anything to address employee burnout and employee retention and staffing problems. Okay, so that again points to the need to take a closer look at what's going on within SPD management and whether they're pursuing good management practices that can make sure that you're not losing good employees. Robart overall was pretty positive about the changes the city is making to move some functions of the police department to civilian teams, but he stressed that the city will have to work harder on both ramping up those civilian teams and on making sure that the Seattle Police Department continues to improve. So that's the overall takeaway from that meeting this week.
Okay.
And then finally, I want to, in public safety news locally, I want to praise another article in the South Seattle Emerald this week entitled OIG Auditor Resigns, Claims OIG Puts OPA Allegiances Over Police Accountability. And that was, by Carolyn Bick. Bick got a hold of key documents and interviewed a senior level auditor in the Office of Inspector General for the Seattle Police Department, who resigned and has filed a formal ethics complaint with the City of Seattle's Ethics and Election Commission, and has sent that complaint to the city's HR Investigations Unit Director and City Council Member Lisa Herbold, who chairs the council's Public Safety Committee. In their 7 months of working at the OIG, the senior auditor found that the OIG is, quote, more interested in preserving political allegiances than providing police oversight, end quote. Those political allegiances include a very friendly personal relationship between Office of Police Accountability Director Andrew Meyerberg and Office of Inspector General Deputy Inspector General Amy Tsai. Okay. So what kind of friendly personal relationship that is, I don't know the details of. That's in the complaint and is apparently not public right now. Now, the Office of Inspector General's Director, Inspector General Lisa Judge, also routinely put pressure on staff to not be critical of the OPA, even though the Office of the Inspector General is supposed to exercise oversight over the OPA, which, as we found out over the past year, seldom issues reports that are critical of Seattle Police Department officers. Now, the complaint details specific instances in which the OPA got the facts wrong in their investigations of complaints against the Seattle Police Department that resulted from their response to the George Floyd protests last year. When the senior auditor pointed out these mistakes and tried to get them corrected, Lisa Judge and Amy Tsai told that person to lay off and that it would jeopardize the OIG's collegial relationship to the OPA and Andrew Meyerberg for anyone within the OIG to criticize anything done at the OPA. This is a very serious allegation of a conflict of interest between Amy Tsai, Lisa Judge, and Andrew Meyerberg, and the city has to investigate it and take it very seriously. And I highly recommend that people go back and find that article and read it. It's long, but it's really good and super important that the city get its police oversight groups functioning the way they're supposed to and not allow them to become part of some old boys network at the Seattle Police Department, which it appears is happening.
And that's been a problem with the OPA for many, many years.
Yeah. Now, I just want to, again, tell you what the name of that, the title of that article in the South Seattle Emerald, OIG Auditor Resigns, claims OIG puts OPA allegiances over police accountability, and the author is Carolyn Bick.
And you can find her work regularly there at South Seattle Emerald, and if you click on her, the image and name, it'll list the other articles she's written. She's a really good person
she's
to be
very
following.
Good. Very good.
Follow her on Twitter as well. So.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, she's a great reporter.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope.
All right. Well,
just if you want to read more about it, go find the article.
Further developments. You know, every time you think this section is going to get shorter, further developments in the pandemic this week.
Oh, dear Lord. Yeah, it's been a bad week for the spread of the pandemic, for the COVID-19. The numbers in King County and statewide skyrocketed this week. We're now close to 1,000 new cases a day in King County and close to 4,000 new cases a day statewide. Those numbers are approaching the numbers at the peak of the pandemic last January. The vast majority of those cases are among unvaccinated people. But there's enough of a pool of those people that the virus is spreading very rapidly. The other item of concern, and we're seeing this nationally as well, is the very limited capacity, both here and nationally, of pediatric beds. Because, you know, caring for sick kids is a very specialized thing. They're not the same as, you know, they're not little adults. We're seeing a lot of hospitalized kids, mostly from parents who are not vaccinated. And of course, under the age of 12, the kids can't be vaccinated. And we're getting ready to go back to school, which is a disaster in the making. It's very, very concerning. We saw that we're getting a lot of, media coverage of the Washington State University football coach, who is very noisily refusing to get vaccinated, even though the WSU, as with other state universities, is requiring faculty and staff as well as students to be vaccinated this fall. But, you know, they seem to have made a carve-out for the athletic department, which for anybody who knows anything about modern universities, especially large land-grant universities, that shouldn't be a surprise because the athletic department pretty much runs the school. It brings in a lot of money from alumni, a lot of money from the games. But, you know,
but those games can be super spreader events.
The games can be super spreader events, and the games can be forfeited if the if the teams don't have enough players who are out of quarantine to be able to play. And that would cost the schools a lot of money. So, you know, it's very clear that the athletic director and the president at WSU are not going to hold the football coach accountable for this. That puts it in Jay Inslee's lap as the only other person who can do anything about it. The guy should have been fired yesterday. It's a terrible message to be sending out to the general public. And a serious public health menace also, given how many people congregate at football games. As Maria said, it's a potential for a super spreader event.
And it doesn't matter if it's outdoors or not with the Delta variant. We actually had our own super spreader event going on here just a couple weeks ago. That about 160 cases have arisen that are linked to the outdoor Watershed Country Music Festival that was held at the Gorge on the weekend of July 30th to August 1st. So those outdoor events where lots of people are packed together without masks on, maybe some of them are masked, but the vast majority are not, those can easily become super spreader events with the Delta variant. It's just that much more transmissible.
And that's not a one-off because Lollapalooza in Chicago also was that same weekend, and at least 200 cases have been traced so far to that. So, it's an extremely communicable disease, and people need to take it seriously. Mask up when you're in indoor public spaces. We had a
letter. Outdoors. I mean, let's just face it. With the communicability of the Delta variant, you should be wearing a mask anytime you're outside of your home at this point.
And that includes if you're fully vaccinated.
Yeah.
So we had a letter this week from 35 heads of the different health districts in Washington state, all urging public mask mandates. And the question at this point is, you know, when's Jay Inslee going to do something to shut things down? Because we're seeing an exponential rise in the number of cases. Hospitalizations are increasing. Local hospitals are pretty much full. And, you know, this is a serious concern. The pandemic is not over. I know I keep saying that every week, but you know what? I've been right. And too many people want to believe that things are back to normal when they are not at all.
Yeah. Now here in King County, we have over 70% of adults vaccinated, but that still leaves about 30% of us who are not. That's almost a third of the adult population is running around without having gotten a vaccine.
Yeah, it's about 600,000 people.
Yeah, that's a lot of people. And those folks can not only spread it, but they can also severely tax the hospital and healthcare systems by getting sick. And even if you've been vaccinated, you can get a breakthrough infection. And also, you're not likely to get deathly ill, but it's no picnic to get this virus and to then get COVID long haul symptoms for months and months afterwards.
You're very susceptible to long haul, even if you're asymptomatic initially. So, yeah, everything's bad about this.
Yeah, and I also want to talk, Jav, you know that as a person who is immunocompromised, that the CDC is now recommending a third shot for folks who are immunocompromised, correct?
Yes, that is correct, and the FDA approved it. That was Thursday night, and the CDC panel recommended approving it on Friday. It has not been approved yet, but it probably will be this weekend or Monday. So for people who are immunocompromised, the CDC is going to lay out guidelines of who exactly is eligible in that category. The people are eligible for those third shots immediately.
And that comes out of studies that show that immunocompromised folks tend not to make antibodies with just two vaccine shots. They tend to need three or four for their bodies to make a significant number of antibodies to the COVID-19 virus.
Yeah, and France has been doing this since April, so we've got a pretty good data set now that is not only safe, but very helpful.
Yeah. And also this week, after seeing the Delta variant send pregnant women to the hospital with very serious illnesses, the CDC is now recommending that pregnant women and breastfeeding women get vaccinated. It's estimated that 23% of pregnant women in the U.S. have received a single dose of the vaccine, and the rest have not received any vaccine at all. Being pregnant increases the risk of serious illness if you catch COVID-19. And you are more likely than non-pregnant women to need intensive care, including being hooked up to a ventilator or a heart-lung bypass machine. The risk of death is 70% for pregnant women who have to be hospitalized for COVID-19. That's extremely high.
And there have been just some awful stories of women who gave birth, were able to hold their bodies for a minute, and then were hooked up to a ventilator and died.
And you don't want to be that. Yeah, you don't want to be that.
Just awful. Yeah.
And catching COVID can also increase the risk of developing preeclampsia, which is high blood pressure during pregnancy, very dangerous, of going into labor early and delivering a preemie. And can also increase your risk of losing the baby. It's also been linked to gestational diabetes and delivering a low birth weight baby. In rare cases, pregnant women who are severely ill with COVID can pass the virus on to their babies in the womb. And new studies have shown that the vaccines do not increase the risk of miscarriage. They do not affect fetal development. And a mother who is vaccinated can pass her antibodies through the placenta to her baby in the womb so that the baby then has some protection against COVID-19.
Yeah, because newborns generally do not have much of an immune system.
Yeah. So, and if you're breastfeeding, you can also pass your antibodies to your baby if you have them and you're breastfeeding. That's a very good thing. And I have to tell you, if I were pregnant, I would want those antibodies ASAP. I would be lining up to get two or three vaccine doses.
I don't understand the rationale of, well, I'm not going to get vaccine because I don't think it's safe. Well, you know, side effects from the vaccine are way easier to deal with than getting the virus.
Compared to the virus. They're very mild compared to the virus. And some women I know are hesitating because it's natural when you're pregnant to not want to introduce things into your body that you think might harm the baby or harm fetal development. But the CDC is recommending this now, and they were waiting to recommend it because they were waiting for the results of studies of pregnant women who were vaccinated and then carried their babies to term. That takes time, several months, in fact, to see if those women had any complications in their pregnancies, whether they delivered healthy babies, delivered babies in some cases who had immunity to COVID-19, and if those babies and mothers remained healthy for a while afterwards. And what they're finding is that there are no side effects that linger for mothers and babies. It does not affect, the vaccines do not affect fetal development, and mothers and babies are healthier if they have those antibodies than if they don't.
Yeah.
So highly recommended there.
All right. Anything else on COVID-19 for right now?
Nope. Well, only that, you know, it's not just unvaccinated areas in the South that are seeing an increasing new cases at this point. It's also urban areas and other parts of the country, including Seattle,
yeah. Our rates of infection are as high as they were in January during the peak. Right now, they just skyrocketed over the last month. It should be extremely concerning to our governor, and he should be considering he should announce fairly soon more restrictions, mask wearing in public, and that bars and restaurants need to close.
Yeah.
And no mass gatherings, even outdoors.
The number of new cases in King County has increased something like 12-fold over the last month.
Yeah, it's just skyrocketing.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we got 10 minutes left. Let's move on to national and decisions coming out of the U.S. Supreme Court. this week?
Yeah, there were a couple of important ones. The Supreme Court blocked implementation of the eviction moratorium in New York State. This is significant because there are a number of other cases in lower courts at this point, including the CDC's extension of the eviction moratorium, that are being challenged. And the New York precedent suggests that CDC eviction
I thought it was just one aspect of the eviction moratorium that they overturned, not the entire thing.
That is true, but it was a serious aspect, and it applies to the other cases as well. So the concern is that we could see a decision in the next month or so that overturns part or all of the national eviction moratorium as well, which would be disastrous in terms of housing policy and you know, homelessness and all the rest of that.
Jav, here's the issue that was blocked by the Supreme Court. They blocked the part of the New York eviction moratorium that would allow renters to avoid eviction by just filing a paper form. They have to actually challenge it in court, which I think is the case in many of the state eviction moratorium, state and local eviction moratoriums that we're seeing, like the one in, like the ones here in Washington State and Seattle, that, it has to be used as a, defense in court. Rather than just being able to file a piece of paper, a document with the state or the city.
Yeah, I think that's a significant hurdle because, you know, if you're juggling stressed finances and trying to make ends meet, you know, trying to incorporate a court appearance into that can be a real hurdle for a lot of people. So.
Yeah, it can be, but I think that's an important distinction. It didn't completely overturn the eviction moratorium.
Okay. So the other case that I wanted to talk about was Amy Coney Barrett rejecting without comment an appeal from plaintiffs in a case protesting the implementation of mask mandates at Indiana University. Of course, Indiana is Coney Barrett's home state, and they were judge shopping. They thought she would be most sympathetic of all the judges on the court, and she rejected it. So that opens the door for mask mandates in public employees in a number of other settings. Certainly, all the universities in Washington State have those in place. So that was good news. So it's been a mixed bag this week.
Mm. All right. Well, one of the things that has not been good news this week or this entire summer is the fires that have been raging. And Dixie Fire continues to expand.
Yeah, it's now over 500,000 acres, which is huge. 31% containment at this point. And, of course, we've been getting the upper-level atmosphere smoke from that fire the past several days in Washington, Western Washington as well. So, that's the biggest, but there are over 100 different wildfires in California and, of course, a number of fires in Oregon as well. So,
yeah. Yesterday here, Seattle was the second worst, had the second worst air quality in the world after Vancouver, BC, because of the smoke from the Dixie Fire and the other fires burning in California, in Eastern Washington, in British Columbia, kind of all
Vancouver,
around.
And Vancouver, of course, has the same problem, except they're getting more smoke from the BC fires as well. So, yeah, it's not good.
I kind of want to jump, talk a bit about the IPCC report.
Yeah, it would be a good time to talk about the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report. Just as an aside to that, I want to mention that July was the Earth's hottest month ever recorded, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, looking at their records back that go back 142 years.
Yeah, and we're seeing serious heat waves right now across the Northern Hemisphere, certainly Southern Europe, Asia, North America, It's all hot.
Yeah. So on Monday, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released a new report on the status of climate change. Essentially, they're saying expect more severe weather in the future, regardless of what we do, that climate change is now baked in. But we can still affect how severe future storms, droughts, wildfires, floods, heat waves, ocean die-offs, and pandemics will be if we act now. The Earth has warmed about 2 degrees Fahrenheit, or 1.1 degrees Celsius, from the pre-industrial era. If we act now to cut carbon emissions immediately, we could limit the global temperature increase to 1.5 degrees Celsius. But if we do nothing, it's set to rise about 3 degrees with the current policies that are in place in industrialized countries. With each degree of increase, it's that you see increasingly dangerous and fatal effects to the to the global climate.
Widespread droughts, crop failures, migrations of mass numbers of people because they can't support themselves.
Climate refugees and whole areas of the planet that could become or probably will become uninhabitable. Now, the next UN climate summit is set for this November in Glasgow, Scotland. The 10 biggest emitters of greenhouse gases will have to bring real plans for cutting their greenhouse gas emissions even further to the table. Those nations are headed up by China, which is number one, and the U.S., which is number two, with the European Union at number three. And then the others are India, Russia, Japan, Brazil, Indonesia, Iran, and Canada. In addition to cutting carbon emissions, those nations need to have a plan to cut methane and industrial gases like hydrofluorocarbons and perfluorocarbons, some of the very gases that are right now in high demand in the production of everything from Teflon to cosmetics to pharmaceuticals to more air conditioning units.
And it hasn't gotten a lot of attention, but the fact that we've had record high temperatures in Siberia much of this year, mm-hmm. as well as, you know, widespread wildfires, means that the permafrost is melting, which in turn means the release of a lot of methane.
And not just the swampy areas of Siberia are releasing methane. This year, in the past 12 months, scientists have discovered a new source of methane from melting permafrost that they hadn't been able to take into account before, but is now showing alarming signs of contributing to global warming, and that's methane released from limestone rocks.
You know, every time we learn more about climate change, it gets worse.
It does, yeah. And the degree to which it's affecting the climate now and which it could affect the climate in the future is very alarming. And this is really kind of our last chance. You know,
the track record of global governments in dealing with this is not very good so far.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. So we'll see what happens in November. But if you want to affect what happens in November, it would be a good idea to communicate your concerns to the Biden administration.
And to Republicans in the Senate, because the infrastructure bill that is currently languishing in the Senate, the smaller one was passed this week, but the larger one, which has a lot of climate change related investments, is still being held up in the Senate. So
I thought the Senate voted on that.
Not yet.
Thursday or Friday.
No.
But you can still communicate with your representatives and let them know that we need to move faster on climate change. And there are also local initiatives that the city council is working on, like green building standards and eliminating natural gas in new buildings that the city council has not passed, and that people can voice their concerns to their local governments about things like that as well.
Yeah.
Yep. Time to walk the walk. Mm-hmm. Knock, knock. All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this week, but hopefully we'll have you both back same time.
There will be more next week, I promise.
Oh, yes.
And it'll all be good news, as it is every week.